Hello, I'm Marshall.
And I'm Stephen.
Welcome to Emissaries of Prophets, the bi-weekly show where we discuss the political economy of the Federation Outpost in the Bajoran sector of the Alpha Quadrant. In other words, we discuss how decisions get made, how opportunities are distributed, conflicts resolved, and who gets screwed over. Spoilers, it's usually the Bajorans. This week we have a special treat for both you, the listener, and for us. The co-host of this show, we are talking to one of our favorite Star Trek and occasionally Marvel podcasts, the Sci-Fi Sistas, a collaboration of four content creators who have abundant, incisive, and wonderful insights into the science fiction we love through the lens of Afrofuturism, feminism, and how to look at the world as it is and what it could be. Welcome to Tamia, Sabrina, and Yvette.
Hi!
Great to be here. Whoop. Thanks. That was nice.
What's up, family?
Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, maybe we'll start things off with just a little description of kind of your background with Star Trek, you know, the what we call the STCV, you know, the Star Trek history.
Okay.
Who's going first?
You go first cuz you spoke.
Oh, okay. I'm Yvette, and my background is basically I was born into Star Trek. My mom's a big fan, still is. We watched it every night, came on twice a night in New York on WPIX. I didn't really watch it. It was just on. We had one TV, so that's what you watched. And then my then boyfriend watched TNG in college, and I watched because it was on. But I got into it through probably DS9 and the movies, the TOS movies. So I've been watching ever since.
Sabrina?
Well, I am the OG Star Trek person, so I was there with Whoopi watching it. So I was, I was that, like, you know, 9-year-old that saw the first shows come on and thought, what in the world? In fact, it was my little brother that was watching it first, and he came running down to tell me that, you know, this show was on, and, you know, we both were watching it and just were freaked out because we just loved science fiction from when we were little kids. And so I'm from when I am the TOS original broadcast Trekkie.
Cool.
And I'm Tamia, and I came into Trek in its first round of reruns in the 70s. It was my babysitter, so TOS it was me and TOS and Captain Kirk hanging out, and Uhura. Captain Kirk was my first crush. believe it or not, I remember.
Real, yeah.
Yeah, I remember being like 7 years old and being just smitten. You know, it's crazy. It's weird.
Right.
I know it was weird.
You could do worse.
Sure. Yeah, he's got a real smolder, though, right? Like, yeah. When he looks, he's just like, whoo!
You would give that
listen,
look.
Listen.
It was melting a seven-year-old little girl's heart.
That does not sound right.
No, it doesn't.
As much as he had his
shirt
off.
I was at least 9.
Right.
But I presented 15.
You presented 15.
You're not right. Whoa.
See, the show. This is what you guys get for asking us to be on your show. Yep. Derailed already. And okay, so I went, I really started paying attention to Trek when I was, when Next Gen was on, like Yvette, that was my show. Like, but I really liked it. So I watched it every time I could watch it, and was there with the original DS9. DS9 became my shiznits. Like, yes. I mean, it was just, I saw DS9 and I fell in love, you know, and so I've been with the franchise ever since. I mean, like, I watch everything. I watch it all. I don't really love it all, but I like it all because it's Trek. Right. You know, even the even the Abrams movies, you know, like I don't love them. But
we've seen them multiple times.
I have, and I will watch them again probably.
Fantastic.
So one of the things we do on the show is we just kind of talk a little bit about what was going on contemporarily to the release of the episode. I'm going to mention it quickly, but I'm not going to talk much about it because we're going to come back to it. But the episode we're reviewing today, The Visitor, came out October 9th, 1990. 95. But however, this is just a week away from the Million Man March in Washington, D.C., which was called by Louis Farrakhan. And again, we'll get into it more, but it was a major civil rights march in Washington. Came out, and again, would have been definitely, I think, being talked about. You know, the lead up to it was occurring during the release of this episode, and I think it's germane to what we're going to talk about today. Again, the Bosnian War is escalating during this period. Maybe not the war, the U.S. involvement is escalating. The U.S. has been importing Afghan Mujahideen fighters out of Afghanistan into Bosnia, have been doing arms drops. U.S. special forces are doing targeting in the former Yugoslavia at this time. They're picking the places they're subsequently going to bomb in the coming weeks. And we'll talk more about this. But also, I think a big 90s moment occurred this week as well, just a few days before the release of this episode. O.J. Simpson was acquitted on October 3rd. He's found not guilty of the murder of Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. I think lots has been said about this. I don't think we're surprising anyone here. The core contention of the defense's case centered on dismantling Nicole and Ron's characters and fixating on a glove found at the scene. Defense attorney Johnny Cochran arguably creating an early meme with his mantra, "If the glove does not fit, you must acquit." I've seen him put it on. I don't know. I'm not so convinced. It's tight. But anyway, it's a big moment. And I think the O.J. Simpson case, you know, is one that's I realize I use this word a lot on this podcast, but it's fraught. Right. It's tied up. It's about class. It's about race. It's about kind of all of the
masculinity.
Things that are, yeah. Masculinity mm-hmm. and violence against women, and particularly, you know, how just all of the fears that we're kind of roiling about get sort of, you know, the O.J. Simpson case becomes a metonymy, I think, for a whole bunch of things. And some of those things are what's at play in the Million Man March. But anyway, we'll talk more about this subsequently. The Visitor, Season 4, Episode 2. I'm going to summarize it really quickly. Please feel free to interject, guests. Marshall, at any point, if you feel I missed something, we open on an elderly Jake Sisko injecting himself with a hypo spray in a grand and well-appointed room in a fine house. It's raining. Thunder is cracking. It's very portentous. He's interrupted by a knock on his door, and a young woman named Melanie presents. She says she's there to talk about his writing and the mystery of why he stopped at the height of his career. Jake notes that on any other night, he would send her away, but tonight's different, so he's going to invite her inside. Jake proceeds to tell how he was orphaned in a warp core accident aboard the Defiant. We get, like, you know, cutbacks and forth to the Defiant and DS9. Jake learns that his father is, in fact, not dead, but trapped between worlds, intermittently appearing to be with Jake for a short period. Jake talks about the morning and his late-in-life obsession with attempting to bring his father back. That's ultimately why he leaves writing, becomes he embarks on a quest that costs him his promising career as a literary figure, his marriage, and on this night, his life. Jake learns that by dying, he can sever the quantum bond that is keeping Ben trapped in stasis and return into a normal flow of time as if he had never left. As Jake is dying, Ben appears one last time in aforementioned well-appointed room, and they spend the last few moments together. Before Ben is restored to his timeline, traumatized, but reunited with his son as he knew him. And God, this must be awkward for Melanie, but arguably she and everyone else in the universe no longer exists. So that's a right. fun thing to think about.
Well, or maybe they continue. Necessarily don't exist. They may not exist. They may not have had this episode. You know, maybe she didn't have the notes anymore, but
right, she might yeah. still
just gonna yeah. have to find her way on her
Andrew
own.
Andrew Robinson's daughter that played that.
Yeah,
I did not know that.
Yeah, you did. Every cool. time no, I look yeah. at it now, she looks just like him.
She looks.
I
like
know,
him, yeah.
right?
She does. Mm-hmm. She looks yeah. like him.
Once I realized that, and then just looking at him, I'm like, oh yeah, I can see your daddy all up in you.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. <He's> not, she was cute. So.
This is an interesting show because it doesn't follow like typical Trek A plot, B plot, right? Mm-hmm. There's just really the one, the one story, which is makes it very unique.
And you know why?
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 Why? Tell us. I want to know.
Okay. This is a spec script. This is a spec script. This is a freelancer writing. So this isn't somebody in the writer's room doing this. This is somebody that just wrote a story that was so good. And, you know, I did my little research on this because I knew I was coming on this show. So I didn't just happen to know this, but I researched this, okay, and found out that when they got the script, they actually thought that this might have been written by Michael Piller and Jerry Taylor as a pseudonym. But Michael Taylor was a real guy. This is his first script. This is the first time he sells a script to Star Trek, and he's going to go on to become one of the most prolific writers, and he's going to be a real mainstay in Voyager. But this is his first script, so he's like out of the box. He's an outlier, and that's why the script doesn't follow, I think, the classic Star Trek A, B thing. Right. Mm. I'm just saying.
Go ahead.
I just looked him up. He also wrote In the Pale Moonlight, which is...
Yes, he did. Yes, that's
incredible
where I
want him from. That he's got these like two so good episodes.
Yes. Yeah, he loves my time. Favorite. He loves time travel. He's all in it. He's Battlestar Galactica. This man's the shit. Okay, can we swear?
Yeah, you can swear. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Is this explicit?
Is there
we got
a
little orange E?
It
there.
Is. It is now.
We're here.
No, Michael Taylor is really something, and I love this story because this was back in the day when, you know, Star Trek used to accept spec scripts.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Which is no longer the case. Anymore. Yeah, like that's that's a bygone
so,
day.
So when this first came out, like when I was watching it when it was on, I did not like this episode.
Can we all clutch our pearls?
It's not that the episode was bad. It was just like, so the Way of the Warrior was on. Right. It was like two episodes. I'm like, this is excellent. This is the way it's supposed to be. Then this thing comes. I'm like, what? Wait, what is this? What happened?
How old would you have been at the time?
Well, I was an adult, you know. Okay. This is what, 95? So I was, I had my first child this year. So that year. So I was, you know, I was an older person, I guess. I mean, I wasn't old, but, you know. No.
You were a child.
I was an adult. Yes, living and living and earning my own living and stuff. But I was like, "What is this? I don't want to see this. I want more Worf. What is happening? They just brought Worf in, and then we get this." And I was like,
"She wants more Worf."
Yeah, so I guess you're right because we go from like the thing that is being influenced. The Bosnian War is influencing this story of, you know, Worf and the Klingons and all the stuff that's happening, and then we go to like this little internal personal story.
Right.
Whoa.
Yeah, you barely see any space represented. Right. You know,
no.
And, everybody's
you know, it's very much of like a portrait. You know, it's a portrait. It's a character study. It's almost, you know. But I mean, just every time when I watch it, I just get this sense of portraiture, you know, and real deep intimacy with these characters. And, you know, and that's amazing that it can carry a Star Trek episode, you know, and one written like this. I mean, there's just
it's
so many.
It's brilliant. It totally stands by itself. All alone. You can watch it without of order, without knowing what you can watch it without knowing what is going on in the Dominion or Klingon War.
Right.
And you've got everything you need because
you can watch it you can watch it without even knowing who these characters are previously.
Yeah.
Right. Because they tell you everything. Exactly. Jake in the narration, he tells you everything you need to know.
It's very well like contained.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is surprising, like looking back at Deep Space Nine, that it becomes so serialized and like each episode sort of plays into the next, and then this one just sort of stands alone. It's like it could have gone in almost any spot, like they put it this week, but it could have gone any other week and been just as good because it didn't matter where it was at. It was just like, oh yeah, it's a thing that happened.
Exactly. Like, there was this time when I saw my dad and die, and then he came back, and then the next week it's like, oh yeah, okay.
Yeah, right. It's a TNG episode.
You gotta love that line though. When he says, and then he says the worst thing happened to a young man that could ever happen. Mm-hmm. My father died, and I just every time that line comes up, I just
that's a killer right there.
Yeah.
And so we are all saying that you don't need to know anything, but because you do know everything, that line is just it's just the icing on the cake when it comes to that episode. So even knowing everything makes it even more special.
For sure. Yeah, because we've got this like deep relationship of Jake and his dad, and that like they're so close. And it's such a good example of fatherhood on TV, just like in general.
Because
looking back at like other TV shows that are on, and there's like a bunch of sitcoms, and the dads are like doofuses and not really in their children's lives and just sort of like kind of useless parents. And then you've got Ben, who's just like intimately involved and cares and shows all of this. And then Jake loses him and you're just like, oh, you know,
I think if you compare it to other TV shows, and I just really thought of this, where the father is the only parent and you have like The Courtship of Eddie's father, you have Bachelor Father, you have all these other ones where the father was cool and he usually had like an opposite sex child or he had a young child. But, you know, now Cisco had this grown, he's 18, and you still see this instead of this rebelling like they usually do with the young female, like, you know, mother, I hate you. There's none of that. There's a little bit of it maybe at some point, but Jake is totally into his dad, so much so that when he loses it, he loses his dad, he loses it. Mm-hmm. It's just, he's done. Like, for the rest of his freaking adult life, he cannot go on. It's amazing.
I like that they showed, I always think The Visitor is Jake finally letting us know how much he loves his father. Because we always see how Ben feels. So, you know, this showed how much, you know, Jake just adores him. Because that's basically what it is. He's showing you how much he adores that man, and he appreciates everything that he is. He doesn't care that he's a prophet or, you know, anything. That's his dad, and I love that fact that they make sure we understand Jake feels the same way that Ben feels. It's a, you know, they both adore each other, and that love between them, it's everything that DS9 is. It's everything I love about DS9. And then to bring Cassidy in is just extra, because I love that whole dynamic with Cassidy. So it's a great love story too.
I cried.
That's all I got.
I cried a lot.
Always.
During this episode. Yeah.
I made me cry just watching it again to get ready for this. I had to cry again.
Every time. Yep. Every time.
Yep. No joke. Every single time I cried with this episode. I mean, it's just you know, not only is it like a celebration of Black love, you know, but, you know, it's just so, such powerful performances by both of them, you know,
Tony Todd does great work.
And I was happy.
He's very strong
as
an actor.
Yes. In his, you know, no makeup. He's not the bad guy. He's playing a really emotional part, which is unusual for what he gets cast as. You know, he's Kern, he's Candyman, you know, but here he is as this incredible actor. And I really don't think, even in his turns as Kern, you knew he was a great actor, because he even made us cry when he was Kern. I mean, come on, when they wipe his memories, stop it. I'm like a basket case. Right. But as Jake Sisko, as the older Jake Sisko, I mean, props to Tony Todd. You know, he was incredible in this.
Yeah, because I mean, like, I watched this. So my mother-in-law was recently diagnosed with cancer, and we're very close. Yeah. So I watched this, and this was like at a time for me was very, very, very big in the feels. Mm-hmm. And I think like this idea of parents, like, there's a lot about what parents owe to their children, And then there's this other issue of what do, like, the guilt that comes when you as a parent want need anything from your child. Like, I guess for me, one thing that was, how does Cisco move on after this? Like, I just, that was just like one of the things that just like blew my mind. Like, how do you, how would he cope with the guilt? You know, it's, I mean, it's beautiful and sacrificial of Jake. And then it's also, I just don't know how that was. Yeah. That, anyway, I'm sorry. I'm activated and I may be spilling a little bit, but this is,
okay.
This is something, you know, like, I,
something. The good thing is that from what I remember, nobody remembers, right? No one remembers what happened.
Maybe no one remembers.
Only Cisco.
I don't know.
Cisco remembers.
I think Cisco remembers.
Yeah. He does.
Because he was only feeling a few moments for him. And I think when he said, I'm all right now, I think he really did remember exactly.
That's right,
because
he told
happened.
Him, remember to move out of the way. So he did remember.
Right.
That.
Like,
okay,
no, Cisco definitely remembers at the end. And then that's what that final scene, which is usually such a, like, can be such a throwaway scene on so many shows, right? Is just as powerful as every scene preceding it because of the moment where you can see on his face the knowledge of, like, you know, he's hugging the present Jake to him, and you can, and so there's joy there, also mingled with all of his sadness and mourning over the Jake that he lost. You know,
he just died
right in his arms. And this is the power of Avery Brooks to deliver all those complexities of emotions and convey that part of the story, like, bam, you know, just in one shot. Like, that, he's amazing.
Ben is also kind of coming to a realization of how much he means to Jake. That, like, he's sort of thinking of, like, well, I'm a parent and Jake's going to grow up and have his life without me. And that's sort of a natural progression. And so when he sees these snippets, for him, it's like a normal thing, seeing your kid grow up. And then when Jake actually reveals, like, no, like, I never really moved on from this time. So, like, yes, he sort of, like, feels some guilt maybe at what Jake was, you know, that Jake killed himself to save Ben. But I think Ben also comes to a realization of, like, this kid still needs me, and I'm still, you know, like, there's a lot more to do here. So I still also owe him a lot, not just as, like, him saving my life, but also as a parent, there's still lots of work to do here.
Mm-hmm. Always the daddy.
No, he holds something very fragile, I guess.
Yeah.
Even as he's getting ready to let that fragile thing go.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. He's like, Jake is 18. I mean, even in the beginning, you know, Jake doesn't want to go. He's kind of got his own thing that he wants to do. You know, they're kind of separating in their lives. He's like, okay, you go with Cassidy. I'm just going to hang here. And he's like, oh, you know, come on. This only happens once every 50 years. But, you know, he's realizing as this goes on that his son is totally traumatized and can't deal. I mean, you talk about people crying in Discovery. These people were crying. Everybody was crying. Tony was crying. Jake was crying. Everybody was crying. It's a mess. It's a mess. And I love it. I love it. But you know what? So to go back to what, you know, you were talking about in the beginning about the Bosnian War and all that, I thought it was interesting when we go into the time, you know. Okay, here's my question. I always have that question that somebody please explain to me why Starfleet just gave up Deep Space Nine to the Klingons.
I totally figured that out. I didn't get that. I never understood that one. They just gave it to the Klingons.
Yeah, they just said, well, you know what, I'm done. So we know that these stories are being written in the middle of the Bosnian War. And we know that is affecting the writers or maybe even the plot of this whole timeline, even though we stop here in this very internal and personal story because it was such a great story. But we did, like Yvette said, we just had The Way of the Warrior and the Klingons are coming at them. And now in this story, the Klingons are mad because Bajor has just signed an agreement with Cardassia. And that makes me think, you know, Bosnians have just signed the agreement with whoever. Who do they pal up with? And then everything broke loose and the fight started.
Serbians.
Serbians. Right.
We were killing everybody anyway.
There were all kinds of alliances and all kinds of things going on in that war that I never understood.
A hot mess. Yeah. Always. I was there and I didn't understand it.
I was going to ask you that. I thought this was about the time that you were in the service.
The next year. Okay. We didn't go until 96. That's when the peacekeeping people couldn't peace the keep anymore. So they sent the U.S. military in. Because it was all the UN, and then they sent us in. All us poor slobs that thought we were going to have barbecues every weekend.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Wow.
Wow.
So lucky that you were like a Mako.
No, I was not a Mako.
Starfleet couldn't handle it, they go send the Makos in. Or Federation couldn't handle it, they're sending Starfleet in. You were Starfleet?
I guess so, yeah. I'll take it.
Yeah, baby. That's who you were. Go ahead. Talk about it.
That's Navy. That's Starfleet's more Navy than anything. But we digress. Go ahead. Go ahead. This is 1995 we're talking about. Go ahead.
Yeah, things will continue to evolve there for sure. I think from a writer's perspective, I imagine the reason that they lost DS9 was because without Sisko. Sisko was the mission.
Right.
And without Sisko, the mission
could not
succeed. Yeah. Only Sisko has the secret sauce.
There.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's.
I like that.
That secret black sauce.
That just sounds different.
That's what had
sounds
happened.
Like something you want to bottle up. That's what it sounds like. Put a little bow on it.
So the other thing I thought
in the course of this episode, though, it would have made more sense to have the Bajorans team up with the Klingons, right? That the Klingons are kind of threatening, and then they're like, okay, well, we're going to team up with these bad guys who are fighting our historical enemies, and that's why they get the space station. I didn't get why they teamed up with the Cardassians, but then the Klingons still got this. I don't know. It would have been cleaner if they just said Bajor sided with the Klingons.
What are the Bajorans? They've never been, always been difficult.
Yeah.
They've always been difficult.
That's true. They are. They are a little prickly and a little difficult. And if there was no wormhole there, everybody would like, whatever, Bajorans. Like, they would have been run over like 5 million times. They ain't got no army. That, you know, they farm and shit. They don't know how to, like, hold a gun or phaser. Like, they ain't shit half the time.
You are majorly offending Kira.
Wait a minute. They keep the Kardashians off the planet. What are you talking about?
Yeah. Thank you, Sabrina. Okay.
Well.
All right, fine.
Don't be talking about my girl Kira and the Resistance.
That's because the Cardassians aren't really fighters. The Cardassians want to kill you through subtlety and shit. You know, like, I mean, I'm just saying, like, if they would have been conquered.
They'll talk you to
the
death.
The Bajorans are excellent infantry.
The Breen took them out in a minute. The Breen took them out in a minute. That's all I got to say.
Spoilers. We're getting all kinds of ingenuity.
Hey. Talking all kinds of smack against the Bajorans, but when the Breen came up in there.
We're messing them up. You can't talk about the Breen.
Right.
That's later. Stop.
It's four seasons from now.
You said four. Goddamn, four seasons.
Oh, we are time traveling. Can I time travel? Yeah. I can't time travel.
No, of course not.
We just don't have a temporal headache.
So I'm sorry to loop us back, and maybe this is a direction I want
to
go down.
Bring order to this.
I know we were talking about the Black Fatherhood discourse, and you asked.
You had
a very wonderful interview with Cyril Lofton, I think last year, and you kind of talked about this, and kind of what was the depiction of Black Fatherhood in media, and then because I was just trying to think about like what the discourse was at the time. Again, I was a child at the time, so I don't have a very strong sense of it, but. But Family Matters is running concurrent to this, right?
Yes.
Urkel. Are there any thoughts about how DS9 contrasts with Family Matters? Is that germane at all? I don't know.
I mean, I think it's germane in the sense that Family Matters was the type of programming that, it stayed on for so long because there's a segment of the American population that really wanted to eat that crap up. Like, I mean, like, you know, like we can take some shuckling and jiving Negroes, like that's acceptable. You know, and comedy. Steve, yeah, comedy and bug eyed, you know, like, I mean, come on, that Sambo, you know, like, I mean, it's the same, it's a long and a long tradition of bug eyed black comedic acting, you know?
Yeah, it's true. But you know, you have a really early precursor of, not Cisco perhaps, but in John Amos, when he was on the show, what was that show with?
Good Times.
Yeah. And he was a, you know, father in charge, you know, had a wife, had kids. And he was, I swear to God, that was my father. Yeah. Like, there's nothing going on in this house, if you think, you know. And not in a mean way, but he was just serious. He was the man of the house. And they got him off that show so fast. You know, next thing you know, Florida was a single mother in the projects with three kids. It's like, okay, that's what you really want to see.
And there were actually, the actors on Good Times, like, had serious talks with Carl Reiner and everybody about that. And, you know, I think they were about to walk out, you know, because of that, you know. And, so.
John Amos walked out because he did not like the portrayal of the father. And he did not like the, you know, the shucking and jiving that was coming out with Dynamite and all that. And he was really upset about it and left the show. And so we don't really see anything like that again that is not a comedy. You know, we have Fresh Prince and we have all these other shows and we even have Cosby, but they're all comedies. And it's not until we get to Deep Space Nine where we have a serious black man who loves his family, even his dead wife. And, you know, he's raising that son and there's nothing
and
really
was loved by his
funny.
Father.
Right. Generations of love, continuity.
There's nothing funny about it, you know? It's just nothing funny about it. It's just the real deal.
Right.
And we star it, but that show never gets the props when they talk about, you know, black families in Star Trek. And that's what Sirach talked about with us on that podcast. He was mentioning that, you know, Avery never got the credit. Deep Space Nine never got the credit. So whenever, I think Sirach was saying that, you know, when they came out with this list of the best, you know, black family black family depictions, you know, Deep Space Nine wasn't in it.
Mm. Not even mentioned.
No. And, you know, and he was so, Avery was so conscious of the image that he presented on screen and the traditions and heritage that he tried to put in front of the American viewing public and the rest of the world, you know. And even in The Visitor, you can see in the design of Jake's clothing in The Visitor, you know, it's all African inspired and prints and stuff, you know, like there's a connection to heritage, you know, so it's really a clear message. This is black and it's love, you know,
even in the house
to you,
a house. Yeah. The house
when they go to New Orleans and they have the black mask up on the wall. And I always remember that episode with Cisco when he said, Jake said, I knew this was home when you went back to Earth and brought back the black mask from and put them up on the space station. And I was like, yeah buddy, you know, that's the house now. And every time I watch The Visitor and I see that black African mask on the wall, I think of that episode and like, yeah, he's doing the same thing his dad did.
And during that time, I think probably before that, we were definitely, as Black Americans, were looking at Africa a lot. You know, the way we dressed, probably the art in your home. I know that changed a lot.
Kwanzaa became really popular.
Yeah, definitely. Because once I had my daughter, we celebrated Kwanzaa. That's when we started celebrating Kwanzaa every year in 1995. I knew of it, you know, because, you know, my people are from Harlem. So we definitely knew about it, but it was sporadic. Mm-hmm. You know, we would go to something, but never really in the house. But once we had my daughter, that's when we started definitely celebrating Kwanzaa. So those pieces, and it was always just it became a part of your life. And we saw that on DS9. It's just a part of their life. Mm-hmm. It wasn't anything that we talked about. It was just there. And I love that we just saw that there. That meant in the future, you know, this is what we're represented, you know, what we believe in, how our, the culture is still in the future. That's what it was.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. The culture is still in the future.
Yeah. Because you're doing it for the culture and you want to make sure it stays. We want to keep it.
And that it will even outlast the United States as a construct. Actually, yeah, the white settler regime of the United States will be long gone, and it will still be there.
Well, I don't know about that. But
well, in the case of Star Trek, it is.
Well, I don't know about that.
I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I like
the United States does not exist.
I don't agree with that.
Well, I think the United States. I mean, I think the
Federation is so United States. Come on.
The mentality is exactly the same. Like, you know,
it's exactly the same thing.
It's just replacing a variable and calling it something different.
That's all.
Okay.
We're going out, we're colonizing, we're going to get some planets. Hey, we're going through the wormhole. We're going to see what these people want. We're going to sell them some.
Hey, and not only that, we've got the answers to make your life better. Your life is going to be better.
Can you watch it?
Us.
I mean, like about the root
I'm
beer?
I'm fine. Like, Native Americans were fine. Everybody was fine before white people decided, like, let me go call it, put a flag here. And I just discovered you.
Right. Yeah, sounds like the Federation like, to me. You discovered the wormhole. Been here for 10,000 years. What are you talking about?
The wormhole's been here for Jarns. Like,
discovering?
The eye of the prophet? What?
Right.
Yeah, it's our thing.
Sent Odo through 50 years ago. Told him to come back and tell us what's on the other side. We knew it was there. But okay, so that's my other question in this whole thing is that the Dominion seems to be like not exactly the aggressor in this. It's they were just not.
They never made it through.
Yeah, they're just on the other side. I guess, again, because Sisko wasn't, I don't know, Sisko wasn't the one that, well, he's the one that anchored the wormhole, I guess, so it all is his fault.
They said it.
our galaxy brain take on this show is that everyone is the United States. Even the non-Federation, like that, you know, the Federation is the United States, the Cardassians are the United States, the Dominion is the United States, and it's just different aspects of that. Different states of that, ways of relating to itself and to its own self-understanding. We're not Americans, obviously. But,
right.
I guess it's not so obvious as an English-speaking person. Yeah, touche.
I think that's a really interesting way to think about that.
I know. I'm sitting here just chewing on
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I'm like, because, you know, I mean, especially coming from TOS, like, and it was very clear that, like, I mean, but you're right. Like, it was very clear that, like, Gene was writing United States and Russia, or you know what I'm saying? Like that was clear in TOS. But I think this sort of manifest destiny ideal, like that, I see what you're saying. Like it's just represented in different forms. And that's a very American concept.
Yes, that many nations have taken up.
Yeah.
That we all got from the British.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I mean, it really started. Thanks, Brits.
But when aliens have that manifest destiny, it's like an evil freaking shit.
Right.
Yes.
Don't you try to come colonize
what?
Me.
Yes. So now it's like Dominion. Well, hell no. They're like, no, we're coming over there. We're going to take your quadrant. They're like, no, there's going to be a war.
Now there's going to be a war.
No, we're not taking over. We're coming to do business.
That, exactly.
Starfleet does it. We come in peace.
Starfleet was having none of it. We just discovered
I do
you.
Think it's interesting looking at the Dominion too, though, because it doesn't seem all that different, other than the leadership, than the Federation. Really, like each of those worlds have their own rules, and they get to do their own thing, but they all contribute to the wider, you know. Political organization that is the Dominion and have their own autonomy within it, and it's just like a large galacto-political organization, very much like the Federation, and then when they butt up against each other, like whoa, you guys are bad people.
Oh, just evil.
Yeah.
Well, the Karama don't even know. Are
you doing the same thing? Isn't this?
Well, when they meet the Karama, they ask the Karama, like, who are the Dominion? I'm like, I don't know. We just email them. Like, they just talk to, like, a node. Like, they just beam signals to a node, right? They've never even met anyone from the Dominion.
Like, they weren't having any problem with them. They were like, yeah. Just over there. So, okay. So in this universe that is Jake's alternate universe, the Dominion has just stayed on their side of the wormhole, and the Klingons now have the space station, and Bajor and the Cardassians are hanging out, and the Federation has just pulled back. They have just pulled back, like NATO pulling out of Bosnia, right? I mean, what is that? What is going on there? I don't know. Is that what we're saying? Is that what they're trying to say to us in this episode?
I don't even, was this written during this time? I mean, just because it came on during this time doesn't mean it was
I mean, the war. Yeah, I think the war is very, like, America's involvement is only beginning now, right? So the war was, I think, at this stage, peripheral. The war was very peripheral. It's like, oh God, like, I mean, yeah, like a lot of conversations about those terrible, those people over there killing each other, right? I think was largely the perception.
It's definitely, in this one, is just like, I'm just out.
I don't think we were talking about it.
A lot of people weren't talking about it at all. Yeah. I mean,
well, you know, we're Americans and we have American news. we have American news.
Like, I remember OJ though.
World news turned to the BBC. The world news go to the BBC.
It's right. I mean, like, if you really wanted to know what was going on in the world, you had to watch BBC News or you had to watch PBS NewsHour.
Yeah.
You know, other than that, like, you know what's going on. Like, and you find out peripherally, like, you know, there was more fighting in Bosnia today. And you really find out about it, like, this many American service people were killed in Bosnia today.
Yeah, that's the only.
Oh, no, not at that time.
No, I mean, like, no, I'm just using that as an example. Oh, okay, like, you would get, like, this is when you start finding out about conflicts in other parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a footnote to the news. And it's really only told from the perspective of this is how it's affected America today. And other than that,
this was when CNN was big, right?
CNN was big. And it was also, CNN used to be a little bit like it was more unbiased at the time, too.
Real news station.
It was real news at the time.
It was. They were on the ground because I know in 96, they were definitely on the ground and they were getting the news back before we were. Mm. I was like damn Steffi on Arm Report. She's killing us over here.
Wow.
She was amazing though.
I think the age of it was definitely the highlight of the age of the embedded reporter within the US military. And then I think when it got to, and then that kind of broke all and kind of beginning with Iraq and then ending in Syria, when it became kind of when ISIS adopted a strategy of murdering journalists specifically to limit the context of debate. But anyway, not trying to shut that down.
One of the other things I thought about when I was thinking about this is that just a way out, you know, we knew of Sarajevo and Bosnia from the Olympics that had happened 10 years before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and it was such a happy time and it was such a beautiful place and everybody was so, you know, we didn't really know this city at all before. Mm-hmm. Most Americans, they'd never heard of it. And they were going to host this Winter Olympic, and it was such a pretty thing, and everybody was happy. And then that was 84. And like Bajor, you know, this world of culture and art and all of this, and then the war comes, and it's absolutely decimated. And we see later these pictures of this very same city that we just really, within our own memory, was such a happy place, and we were seeing, you know, commercials about athletes, and now we're seeing this devastation. It was, for me, that's what really got me, because I remember watching those Olympics and then seeing that city absolutely bombed the crap out of, and just feeling so very sad for what happened to those people. It was just, in a blink of an eye, really. I mean, it was like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. And I always think of that with, you know, Bajor, it happens over 50 years, but in this one, it's 10. But that's the only other parallel I can think of with the two things, that it was something that the world saw just get obliterated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that.
Forgot about that.
That's a happy note. Okay, so moving on.
do you wanna circle back to the Million Man March? I know that was something we talked about on offline as being pretty germane to this episode.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think I think what Million Man March happened October 16th, right? Reset then this episode aired what, October 9th?
Literally one week before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it goes a lot back to the Million Man March was really a response to the vilification of Black men that was so rampant in American society through media. You know, the Black man was always seen to be feared on the news. You know, you would hear, like, if there was a crime perpetrated, you would know that it was done by a Black man because they would say it was done by a Black man. But if there was a crime perpetrated by a white man, they would never say his race. So there were just entire swaths of population at everywhere you turn being educated to fear Black men and to think of Black men and women. I mean, but we're talking about the Million Man March, but to think of Black men in only specific ways. You know, you're dangerous, you're thieves, you're drug dealers, you don't take care of your son, your kids, you're broke, you know, you're on the system, you know, like you're violent. There's all these bombardment of images. And this is kind of goes to what Yvette was talking about earlier with, you know, how in the 90s, there was this huge upswell of connecting with our African heritage and really drawing strength from it. You know, it's direct response to just enough of, we can't take any more of this type of lying on us. You know, we can't take any more of this type of treatment. And I'm so tired of people crossing the street for me because, you know, I remember being a girl at that time and I didn't even weighed like 100 pounds. And these white ladies would cross the street because they were afraid I was going to take their purse. I mean, it's ridiculous stuff, you know? And so there was this huge upswelling of cultural awareness and embracement in the Black community. And the Million Man March was called by Minister Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam and Ben Chavis and the NAACP. And that was controversial in itself because Minister mm-hmm. Farrakhan was extremely controversial.
Still is.
In the black community, he can be...
It depends on the community.
Well, I guess it depends on the community. I mean, but there was a lot of people that really looked up to him. And he was the only one at that time who could mobilize a million Black men. You know, and so this march was called to show and to demonstrate our peaceful love for one another, our deep love for one another, our commitment to one another and to the Black community, and to really put there to the world that we are, we just simply are, and we're going to go about doing our business as Black people, right? And so there was the thing that was really controversial about the march was that the government reporting on the march, which was really like seriously controlled by our media was seriously controlled by official government reporting, straight up lied about how many people were there and tried to underrepresent how many people showed up for this march. There were well over a million Black men on the National Mall that day. I know I was there. I was also at President Barack Obama's first swearing in. There were twice the amount of people, at least twice the amount of people there for the Million Man March than were there for President Obama's swearing in. I've been at almost every major national protest event in this city throughout my life since I was able to go out on my own. I've never seen that many people in this city before. And it was peaceful and it was loving and it was a day of celebration and joy and oneness and togetherness. It was amazing. And I've never seen anything like it before. And I probably won't ever see it again.
Yeah. And people that were there still talk about it. I mean, I was saying my brother-in-law was there and he came down from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he is a black Muslim and went down for the march, and he was not transformed, but it was a major day. Mm-hmm. It was a major day for him. He's older than me, so he would have been, you know, probably in his 40s when he went there that day. Definitely. So he's a grown ass man, and you know, so this was a big deal, and people just came from all over. It was talked about. It was like, wow.
Everybody mobilized buses from all these towns.
Other churches. I was telling Tamia and Sabrina earlier that I remember my church, the men's ministry, they had buses. I mean, the joy that these men had, and all the women, we were making sandwich boxes for them. So we would make sure they had, you know, these sandwich boxes to bring on the bus. And my uncle, who he's not a political person, he doesn't talk about anything that has to do with current events. He watches baseball and he goes to the bar. That's it. But when this happened, you know, I learned so much about him, about his childhood and the things he had to deal with. And the fact that he was just overjoyed by this embracing of black men. He became a leader to get everybody in the neighborhood to go. You know, he just transformed into this different person. And it was just something to see. You know, it was this man who, he's an old, like Sabrina said, this was a grown ass man who did his own thing, you know, but when this came up, he just became, and you know, this leader in our community, you know, and maybe just for a short period of time, but he's still, you know, I never forgot that, you know. Mm-hmm. It was a joy to watch, you know, because I thought of him in a certain way. And then when he became this man, you know, he just, not that he ever didn't walk strong. It was just different. Mm-hmm. You know? Yes, he had a different air to him.
And I think that Sabrina used the right word. That transformative was the word. And I mm-hmm. sat there and I witnessed, you know, I mean, so and Yvette used this other word, and which was joy. And, you know, which was also really powerful. And we don't often get joy, pure joy. You know, we laugh at things and we find things funny, haha. But this was joy. I was watching these buses come in everywhere in town, every church, every black school, every university, everybody was was hosting folks from all over the country. Mm-hmm. It came in on these huge tour buses. Everybody had people staying in their homes, you know, because all the hotels were sold out. So, you know, you put people wherever, but it was, everybody was getting off these buses and bringing these high spirits, and they couldn't wait to be here. I mean, and everybody, they're waving, they're talking, like on the streets, you're talking to people you've never met before. You just, it was a feeling of community. And of a deep sense of communal love that I haven't felt since then. That it was so powerful. It was a look at like what we can be. And I remember down on the mall, you know, men were unabashedly crying at the power of what they were experiencing. You know, when you get love that deep, it's gonna move you. You know, and when you put it all together with all these individuals sharing this experience, it's going to move you. And it was transformative. I watched men walk in there and with one posture and leave with another one, you know, and for years we felt the effects of that day. You know, there is a whole generation of men, and then men you had, and I met people who were like, they're three generations deep, right? You know, grandfather, father, and son. Sometimes great grandfathers were there with them, you know? And so it's something that was one of the most powerful effects in a generation. Mm-hmm. I wish we could have another one today. I think that our kids today could really use it, you know. I think that today, even back then, there's a sense of bleakness and there's a sense of hopelessness, and there's a sense of anger, which is justifiable in so many ways. but I don't feel like there's a sense of hope that is, you know, on such a large scale. And maybe that's just me. Maybe I'm a little pessimistic.
I agree with you. There's no, no, there's a lot of you. Hopelessness. I think the world has a lot of hopelessness.
Yeah. Yeah. So relating this back to The Visitor, you know, it was, The Visitor was right in step with this moment in time in proclaiming this depth of humanity and this love between this father and son, and refuting the commonplace stereotype that was being shoved down our throats all the time about what it was to be Black and what Black families look like, you know, what Black fathers and sons look like. So, you know, I mean, I don't know, I don't think they timed it that way on purpose, but it couldn't have worked out better. They might have. The show is very synchronous.
Because there was a big lead up to the Million Man March. Yeah. So they might remember this could have been anywhere. This is a show that an episode that could have been anywhere. Yeah. So it might have been. And to, you know, they had those three Black leads in one episode. And I mean, you know, I think it was perfectly
timed. I think you might be right, because they actually filmed the shows out of sequence. So they filmed the episode one, and then they filmed three, and then filmed two, but they showed them as one, and you know, right before the march, they showed two. They didn't, you know, change the order.
Because it was the week before, right?
So yeah, so they did show it the week before.
And I wonder,
there was a thought to that.
I wonder how much Avery had to do with that decision.
Oh, everything.
I think it was everything, right? Yeah.
And Tony.
I think that was his decision. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I don't see CBS executives being very attuned.
Well, you know, Ira's always going to
bring in some commercial dollars.
That's it.
It would be on it then, I hate to say.
Yeah, but one of the things we are.
It's a damn good show, though.
It is a good show.
One of the things we are woefully like bad at is like knowing like who the writers are and who the producers are, and maybe like some of like the we really read it in a very surface level, and we miss a lot because we don't get into that. But that's very cool to hear.
Well, I have one other thing that I wanted to bring it in. It has nothing to do with the Bosnian War or the Million Man March, but you know me, my sisters know if we're gonna have a show, Sabrina's gonna research. So I thought it was interesting, and so you know when you write a show it takes a while for it to be broadcast, so he had to have written this show probably a year before, maybe even longer, but I don't know how much longer he did it. So I was looking for things that happened in 1994 that might have influenced him. And Michael Taylor at this time, like I said, he was a freelance writer. He wasn't on any sort of writing team, or he had never published anything or had been paid for any other writing that I know of. And he was a guitarist with a band and a singer at the time in New York. And in 1994, the major thing that happened in the music world was Kurt Cobain killed himself.
That's right.
And I always had to think that the first scene we see is the suicide. And I always thought, like, that was just in the news. And, you know, this was a person that had early fame. He was having a hard time dealing with the fame. And, you know, the drugs came in and whatever else happened. And then he ends up, you know, taking a gun and shooting himself. But I can't imagine that a guitarist in a band in New York is not affected somehow by that occurrence. And I don't know whether that dripped on into The Visitor, but I just want to put that out there.
I like that.
Well, I think it's a very internal story. It's, you know, I know we're talking about all the external and geopolitical things, but as soon as you start talking about a writer, and, you know, to me as a writer, it gets internal. And that's, there was a lot in there about whether you are really a writer or whether you're ever going to be famous. Yeah. And there was a lot of discussion about how that feels, and even giving up your career in order to do something else. Like, he was trying to find his father and he put down his career. I got another thing I could tell you about that. Okay. But All right, here's my other wild out there theory. You know, you called us. This is what you want, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely, this is what we want.
What is the name of the book that Jake was writing that he wrote in this? And the only book Anselm. That you ever hear?
Anselm. Okay.
So what does that mean? I'm like, you know, well, why is that the name of the book? You know me. I'm like, I'm that kid.
Go ahead.
Yes, say it.
Were you asking or were you sorry?
I know the answer. I'm asking.
So there's a Saint Anselm. Marshall yes. and I took this class together at college. Yeah, so and Saint Anselm was a metaphysician. He was sainted for his like modal logic solution.
And what was he doing? What was the theory?
he was trying to prove the existence of God. That
Jesus was real.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what was Jake doing? He was trying to prove his father was that really Jesus was real. All right, class. Yeah. You're dismissed. Yeah. Saint Anselm of Canterbury.
Jake drew four circles and then had a little tilde. Yeah, yes. And he moved it up and down. Yeah.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. I was like, there's a reason why this book is called this bizarre word. Like, why would he call it that?
Bajoran Jesus. That's what he was trying to find.
Bajoran Jesus. He was trying to find it. Yep.
That is not wrong.
No, I'm telling you, I'm liking you guys. All right, you went right there, Saint Anselm.
That's it. Oh, like Catholic school.
Yeah, right? I was in Catholic school, but only for the first like 4 years. And then God I was bless like, you. I know.
Okay, I have another observation that I made watching this. You guys, you want to hear all my observations?
We do. Okay. Yes.
All right. So right
I
after,
don't.
What was
I'm
on
sorry.
The other night?
I'm right. I'm going deep.
I'm going deep into my paw is so strong right now. I can't even tell you. So
I love it.
Okay.
Where's your ear?
So you remember the episode that comes out later? It's called Muse, right? That really creepy one.
Yes.
Jake having his brain sucked out of him and everything by that crazy looking woman.
That's not right.
All right. That's when he, what was the name of the book at the end of that episode? You know, he's writing Anselm.
Right. Yep. He's always going to write that book.
Oh my God.
It's in everything.
Yes. That's the book he's writing. It's coming out of his head then. And then he says in The Visitor, that she says, well, why did you stop writing? And he said, oh, I lost my favorite pen. Mm-hmm. And in Muse, she gave him that pen.
That's right.
Yeah.
And in Visitor, he's writing with that pen on paper. And in Muse, he says, I never use pens. I never use paper. He always used a pad, right?
Right.
But after that, he used the paper and the pen. And then you go to Visitor. He's using the same creepy ass pen. I'm like, oh my God.
Well, she wasn't all bad then, apparently.
Yes, she was. It was wrong. Everything about that is
listen,
just wrong.
I never noticed that until this rewatch, and I was like, oh my God.
Wow.
That was
a good cat. Episode.
It's the alien lady's pen. Go back and watch. Sorry. I was scared to death.
Yeah. That was creepy, though. I mean, she was
so
too old
so
for
Rock
him.
Said that. We talked about that on the podcast, that he was creeped out.
He was really creeped out. Yeah. Or it
wonderful.
Or whatever it was.
Anyway, go back and watch that and just take a look and see that he is writing with the very same pen that he uses in Muse.
Yeah. So I have your permission. I don't have to watch the entire episode, right? I just have to
skip forward to where the pen is.
Why? You don't even have to watch anymore. She just told you.
I know.
Odo getting married to Oksana was kind of cool. You can watch that part of it.
No. There's no need to watch
any
of that.
That is such a creepy episode.
Thanks for bringing us down, Sabrina. Jeez.
I'm just trying to tell you. I went all the way around the circle. I'm like, oh my God, he's got the pen. That's the pen he's talking about. Oh, Jesus.
That's cool.
Amazing. Do you guys have anything else that you noticed or that you thought of or that you wanted to bring up?
Nope. That was my three. Nope. The pen, Saint Anselm, Kurt Cobain.
I was done at the Million Man March. Like,
right.
You don't know where sisters are going to go with this stuff.
Not really.
Well, it's usually at the end of the episode, we kind of fall off.
I think that's a podcast thing, right?
Right.
Again,
it's its own modal
much.
Ontology.
Right.
See, told you we were going to leave the big words to you guys.
Hey, she brought it up.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. Thank you so much for being here. This was a lot of fun. And I think there's a lot more that we got out of this episode because of you guys being here. And those observations are incredible. So
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun to be on here with you guys, like to finally make this happen. Like,
yes.
Like, thank you. Like, cause you know, folks who are listening, like this has been in the works for a long time since the Sci-Fi Sisters first started podcasting. These guys were so sweet and immediately reached out and said, "Hey, do you want to do something together?" Like, sure. And we finally were able to come play, and that's really cool. So thanks for sticking in there with us.
We
appreciate it. Definitely appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. We're definitely going to put a link into your interview with Sarah Clofton into your podcast. And I really recommend people check out the Sci-Fi Sisters. Yeah,
can you tell us like how to find your show and where you're at and everything?
Yvette.
I don't have my intro music. I don't have anything going on yet. You can find us at www.scifisisters.com and everything is there.
S-Y-F-Y-S-I-S.
Listen, they know how to spell it by now.
I'm just saying. Somebody out there might not know us.
Okay. S-Y-F-Y-S-I-S-T-A-S.com.
And on Facebook, we have a page.
On the mothership. You want me to spell mothership too?
The mothership.
And we're on the Twitter.
And the Sci-Fi Sisters book club. So, and on the Twitter.
On the Twitter.
You can find us at Sci-Fi Sisters.
And on the IG.
Listen, this is not our podcast.
Amazing.
This is fun.
Put Sci-Fi Sisters in your Google or your whatever it is, and I'm sure we'll come up. And don't forget Trek Geeks Network.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, please.
We are dead. Please don't forget our podcast network.
If you'd like to hear more about our show, you can find us on the internet, androidsandassets.ca. We're also on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook at AssetDroid. We post about when new shows are available and also try to boost some of the other things that we found interesting on the internet that week. The next time you are gathered with your friends and talking about science fiction, maybe give a suggestion that people should listen to us because we think more people should hear what we're saying, and if you're listening to us, then maybe you think the same thing as well.